About 2.5 hours ago, Dontrell Willis rocked on the mound at RFK Stadium here in Washington, D.C., kicked his right leg high in the air, and whipped his left arm around to deliver the first pitch of the season for the Florida Marlins. It's one of the most distinctive and one of the most effective deliveries in Major League Baseball, and we learn in a new book that Willis developed it playing for fun against his childhood friends in Alameda, California. The story is just one of many collected by our baseball pal Alan Schwartz in Once Upon a Game, where he asks a lot of stars and a few celebrity fans for their most vivid baseball memories. Some involve dramatic moments in Game 7 of the World Series, others pitching to a target spray-painted on the side of a house. So what's your most vivid baseball memory as a player on any level? Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Alan Schwartz joins us now from our bureau in New York, long a contributing writer to the New York Times, as of today, a staff writer for that newspaper. Congratulations on that, Alan, and on the new book.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's great to be here.
And just to follow up on Dontrell Willis, he spray-painted that strike zone on his house and wrote, "My mother wanted to kill me."
Yeah, when he was like 11 years old in Alameda, California, he played a game called Strikeout with his buddies on the streets of Alameda, and they decided they needed a strike zone. And so he took a can of spray paint and just affixed one to the wooden garage in his house. That became the strike zone, and it was there on that driveway that he learned that wacky legs and arms everywhere. I once likened it to resembling a spastic squid. Dontrell has the greatest delivery in baseball, and it's an awful lot of fun to watch. And he learned it because he spray painted that strike zone on the side of his mom's house.
You got a picture of him standing next to the remains of that strike zone.
That's right.
Too. But I love the rules of the game he and his friends played. If you hit it on top of the house across the street, it was a home run. If you hit it off the second story, it was a triple. The living room was a double, and so on. We improvised and had a blast. I think a lot of kids who played baseball in backyards or across a couple of backyards in the summertime had rules like that. Over the hedge, it's over there, it's a triple. Over here, it's a double.
Sure, absolutely. I have a feeling that there are still a couple of, you know, old moldy baseballs in the shrubs of my old house in Scarsdale that are gathering moss from having been lost in the games I would play with my friends Peter and Cliff. I mean, we all played baseball that way. And I think a lot of the fun of this book is that we learn how much these grown men who became mythic figures, whether it's Bob Feller or Dom DiMaggio or Roger Clemens, Yogi Berra, Ernie Banks, they all love the game just as viscerally as we do. Mm-hmm. They just ended up making a living at it, too.
Yeah, and making a living. One of the little chapters in your book, you excerpt from Babe Ruth's memoir.
Yes.
And the home run that you choose to write about, and he chose to write about, wasn't, you know, 714. It wasn't, a mammoth. It was an inside the Parker that he hit when he was a kid playing at St. Mary's in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, when I was researching my last book, the name of which we will go unmentioned, so it's not a shameless plug here, but when I was researching that book, I found an old little article that he had written, that Babe Ruth had written in the first person for Baseball Magazine back in 1918, when he was still a pitcher, of all things. Mm-hmm. And he would talk about how he loved to hit. And when he was 6 years old, his first home run was an inside, well, he didn't call it inside the park job, but of course that's what it was. So I excerpted that in the book, because what this is it's a collection of 35 different essays that mostly I wrote on behalf of the players after having interviewed them. Mm-hmm. Whether it was Pedro Martinez or Derek Jeter, Gaylord Perry talking about the first game he ever won with a spitball, Mike Piazza talking about the day that Ted Williams paid him a visit in the backyard of his house when he was 16 years old and gave him a hitting lesson, George Bush on the day he met Babe Ruth, mm-hmm, back in 1948 when he was at Yale. Most of these are done interviews that I did with the players, and then I ghostwrote the essays on their behalf. However, a few of them were from old, long-lost, manuscripts or whatever that had been forgotten for many, many years. Christy Mathewson remembering Fred Merkel, whose base-running boner back in 1908 cost the Giants a pennant. Hank Greenberg remembering his pennant-winning Grand Slam in 1945. There were a couple here of men who had died many years ago, and I wanted to have them in the book because it just helps paint a more clear picture of how much baseball means to us and to the people who've played it.
And we'll get some callers on the line in just a minute, but I wanted to ask the author of the numbers game.
Ah, thank you.
There's a story you tell about Dom DiMaggio tells. Now, he, of course, everybody remembers his Big Brother's 56-game hitting streak. Dom DiMaggio, he's better than his brother Joe. He's Dominic DiMaggio. Anyway, he had a 34-game hitting streak for the Boston Red Sox, which ended one day when he scorched a line drive. He'd been 0-for-4 in the game, and he scorched a line drive to center field, and his brother Joe caught it, thus ending the streak. But the part I wanted to ask you about was the thing, the only statistic that really matters to me is hitting 300. It would have meant so much. Ernest Slaughter hit exactly 300 in his career. He's in the Hall of Fame. Why? Did he hustle any more than I did? Did he have a better arm than I did? Did he run the bases any better than I did? Did he play defense as well as I did? Who knows? All I needed was 12 more hits, about one per season, and I would have hit 300.
Yeah, I mean, Dominic was very generous with me. As perhaps you know, he is very reluctant to talk about Joe because of all the intrigue about Joe and all the lies and all the craziness that took place with him and Marilyn Monroe and whatnot. But Dom, who still lives in Massachusetts, he's an awfully nice fellow. He spent a lot of time with me recounting the day when his 34-game hitting streak ended. Many people don't realize that while Joe DiMaggio owns the major league record with 56 games hitting safely consecutively, Dom DiMaggio holds the Red Sox team record of 34. So the DiMaggio brothers are very well represented in the annals of hitting streaks. But I mean, what this whole book is it's a collection of memories. You know, Roger Clemens remembering the night he struck out 20 Seattle Mariners to break the record. Ernie Banks remembering the day he first said, "Let's play two," and what moved him to say that. And I decided that with this book being a celebration of baseball memories, what we're also doing is donating a portion of the proceeds to the Alzheimer's Association, because we decided that, hey, if we're going to collect memories in a book, or we're going to preserve memories in a book, let's preserve them in people, too.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we're, of course, speaking with Alan Schwartz, the author most recently of Once Upon a Game. And we'll begin with Richard. Richard with us from O'Neill's in California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. Your cell phone, however, is not doing so well. We'll give it just a second. I'm sorry. See if you can try to call back if you can hit a better cell, Richard. I apologize for that. Let's instead go to, this is Don. Don with us from Detroit.
This is Don from Detroit?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air, please.
Yeah, my most vivid baseball memory is my son played at the time he was 6 till he graduated high school. And one time when he was 12 years old, my wife and I were sitting there watching him play, and he'd never hit a home run. He was a pitcher, and he's a really good pitcher, but he'd never hit a home run in all the time he's played. This one time he hit a home run, and I'm standing there watching him standing by the fence, and as he's rounding third and coming home, I said, way to go, hon, like that, instead of way to go, bud, or something like that. He turns around and looks at me as he's running. The coach looks at me and says, hon, like that.
At least you didn't say sweetie.
Yeah.
That would have been worse, right?
The coach is like, why did you say hon? I was like, I don't know. I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. His first home run, first ever and the last.
Just be glad your son hit a home run. I can confidently say that in all my years of playing baseball, of which there were painfully few, I never even had an extra base hit. Not one. I was very bad.
Well, I always used to say he was a heck of a pitcher, but he couldn't hit a side of a barn with a baseball bat.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Don, and congratulations to your son, Hun, for the home run. But the game, a lot of baseball, Alan, is about fathers and sons. One story in your book is about the father and son home run duo of all time, perhaps.
That's right. Ken Griffey Jr. in 1991, I believe, this is now off the top of my head, was batting third behind the second place hitter, Ken Griffey Sr. His father had been acquired by the Seattle Mariners not long before, and they were batting second and third consecutively. This is when Ken Griffey Jr. was only about 21 years old. His father was about 41 or 42, and they ended up going deep consecutively. Ken Griffey Sr. hit a home run, and then in the next at-bat, Ken Griffey Jr. hit a home run. So they were not only the first father and son combination to play in the same game, they actually went back-to-back Jack. It was really wild.
And the part I liked about it was the trash-talking that immediately erupted.
Oh, sure.
Junior said, mine got out a lot quicker, and his father said, only because yours didn't go as far.
That's right. I mean, apparently Junior's just scraped the top of the fence, just got over. Meanwhile, Senior's just went like 450 feet. So father knew best there. Father retired soon thereafter. But, I mean, again, this is just one of the wonderful, warm episodes that I tried to collect in this book. A lot of them were from interviews I've done over the years and didn't have any room to put in my stories for various outlets, and I decided to build a book around them.
Let's talk with Patty. Patty's with us on the line from Phoenix.
Hi, yes, this is Patty. I'm actually calling for my husband, Mike. He believes that he may have been struck out by Roger Clemens playing Little League back in Ohio when they were 12 years old. And that is one of his great memories, is that there was this 12-year-old pitcher who could blow it by him at such an incredible speed even back then. And we were actually wondering how we might go about trying to find out if that truly was Roger Clemens.
Well, I have to tell you, it'd be a lot more fun if you never did find out, because it'll take the story away. Come on. Most of baseball is built on apocryphal tales. Don't you know that?
That this falls into the category. There's a special category we call in journalism, stories too good to check.
That's right. That's right. I mean,
That may be true.
So. You could probably call the local paper. I don't know if it was at Lima. I'm trying to remember where he grew up. But
My husband was in Tip City, but they were all small towns up there. And so I think Roger Clemens may have been Findlay, Ohio, but I'm not positive on that.
Well, if you want, I have Roger Clemens' cell phone number. You want me to give him a quick ring? What's
your
husband's
name? Just put it out on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Here you go. 513. No, I'm just kidding.
Ask him if he played and what team he played on. So,
And what team is going to play on this year.
That's great.
Patty, thanks very much for the call.
Well, sure. Roger Clemens has only struck out about 10,000 different people, or 10,000 people over since he was six.
Her husband's in
I'm
good
sure he'll remember that.
Absolutely. We're talking with Alan Schwartz, his new book, Once Upon a Game, Baseball's Greatest Memories. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from Pete in San Jose, California. I stood across from our house at 3610 Marison Place in Indianapolis on the hill that was the neighbor's front yard, the crack of the bat, the pop fly, and it headed directly at my glove. I saw it coming down out of the pastel blue. I knew I had it. Next thing, I was getting up off the ground, rubbing my forehead where it hit. I got glasses for nearsightedness soon afterwards.
Oh, that's one. I mean, one of the most wonderful parts of baseball is the inherent failure that people experience trying to play it. And one of the stories in this book actually tries to explain that. Charles Schultz, the former Peanuts cartoonist who died about 7 years ago, was actually a friend of mine. And I spent the day with him back in 1995, and we talked a lot about how he grew up playing baseball and his overriding love for the game. And that's why he used baseball as a device in his strip so much, because it allowed him to let Charlie Brown experience failure. Of course, that's what Charlie Brown was about. It was about just terrible things happening to him all the time. It wasn't just Lucy pulling away the football. It was line drives, disrobing him on the mound and whatnot. And Charles Schultz would talk about how when he was a kid, he was on a Little League team that literally did lose games 40-0. And that's why Charlie Brown ended up losing games 40-0. But he also talked about how when he was in the Army in World War II, he was stationed, I think it was somewhere in France, and even though he wasn't a particularly good player, the other guys in his unit asked him to play. And he got to play somewhere over in France. And it was one of the most warm memories of his life, was playing this pickup game in the middle of nowhere with strangers, but getting to throw the ball around. And so I put that in the book as well.
This is an email from Rich in Grants Pass, Oregon. My memories go back to about 1963 when I delivered the daily newspaper to Mickey Mantle's home in Tenafly, New Jersey. Fridays I'd collect for the week. Can you believe it was only 33 cents? And his wife would sometimes call out for him to come and give me the weekly payment. I would stand there in awe, and occasionally he would actually take me to his side yard and we'd toss a baseball back and forth for a short while. He signed a ball for me to my favorite newspaper boy, Rick. I'm told that it's now worth $200,000 or more.
that would not be, I hope it's worth more than that to the writer of that note, but I'm sure it is not worth that much. But it's a priceless memory that certainly can't be sold, I would hope.
Let's talk with Cesar. Cesar with us from Kansas City.
How you doing?
Okay.
A couple of things that just happened. They mentioned Findlay, Ohio, and I went to school in Findlay, and they mentioned Roger Clemens, and I happened to watch 1988 World Series with Roger Clemens in a restaurant, his favorite restaurant in Katy, Texas, called Guadalajara Mexican Restaurant. So that was pretty interesting to me as I was listening to your talks about baseball. I can talk baseball all day, so I know that that's a very game dear to my heart. But my biggest memory playing baseball was in 1977, watching my local team in Nogales, Mexico, beat up on the Diablos Rojos de Mexico in the championship game.
Hmm.
I was in 77, I was 8 years old, and it was a fun memory for me.
Hmm.
I take your comments off the air.
Okay, thanks very much, Cesar.
Bye-bye.
There's a lot of there's a story a little bit like that about an 8-year-old kid watching a game on television, the World Series, in fact, and watching Roberto Clemente play, the great Puerto Rican player, and this was a kid in Venezuela.
Yeah, his name was Ozzie Guillen, and Ozzie Guillen watched Roberto Clemente, and even though he was from Venezuela and Roberto Clemente was from Puerto Rico, he was still such a hero. This is, of course, before Clemente died tragically and became just a martyr for many things. But Clemente was an incredible hero to all sorts of children, particularly in Latin America. And Ozzie Guillen watched Clemente hit triples and hit home runs and throw runners out from right field. And he's like, I want to do that. I want to play like that. And Ozzie Guillen, of course, ended up being a standout major league shortstop for about 15 years and then led the Chicago White Sox as their manager to the 2005 World Series championship. So
mm-hmm.
It's that sort of connection of generations that I've tried to capture here as well.
There's a number of astonishing stories. My favorite we did not have time to get to and will not is Terry Francona's story about his right fielder in Birmingham, Alabama, a fellow by the name of Michael Jordan. And the best story about that, by the way, is the time that Terry Francona and his right fielder play pickup basketball together.
That's right. There was a very famous pickup basketball game in the Arizona Fall League back in 1994. I was actually there for it, where Jordan just schooled everybody else. Francona was there, and I let people watch as well.
Mm, there's a great story about that. You'll have to read Alan's book to find out what it is, though, because we're out of time. Alan, happy baseball season. Thanks so much. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Neil. Happy opening day, everybody.
Alan Schwartz is the author of Once Upon a Game, Baseball's Greatest Memory. He's now a staff writer for the New York Times. He joined us today from our bureau in New York. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR.